I just want to give you a sense of how the morning is going to be shaped to start with. So we're going to have a mixture of short talks from me, times for discussion, all together and in small groups, and there'll be a couple of moments of quiet. And we're going to break for refreshments as you usually do at 11 o'clock, and we're going to finish promptly at 1. I think that's the plan. And in terms of what we're going to cover, I'm going to share with you a little bit of my story and my work with Together for the Common Good. We're also going to look at reading the signs of the times and the challenges and opportunities that are facing us in this new era. And we're going to explore our calling in this context, what it means to be God's people in these times of unravelling. So let me start by just giving you a brief picture of who I am and a bit of my background and about how Together for the Common Good happened. So we're a small, independent, non-partisan UK charity. We're dedicated to civic and spiritual renewal. We work across the churches, and we draw particularly on the theological body of thinking known as Catholic social thought. And this helps us help the churches reimagine their vocation to be a blessing on society at a time of profound change and instability. And we work in practical ways by resourcing local churches, leaders, Christian organisations, young people and schools. We produce resources, we create platforms for thought leadership and public conversations. So just let me tell you how this started. So as Phil said, I grew up in an Anglican family. My dad was Bishop David Shepherd, who became the Anglican Bishop of Liverpool. He had this 22-year partnership with Catholic Archbishop Warlock, which, as many of you would remember, became a groundbreaking interconfessional civic friendship that blessed a troubled city. And they overcame the historic rupture of sectarianism, and they became community leaders at a time of instability and division. But I was a rebel, and I was estranged from the church. From my mid-teens to my mid-20s, I was quite lost. And then unexpectedly, I had a conversion experience in my mid-20s. Quite unexpectedly, against my expectations, I was called into the Catholic Church. Then for the next 23 years of my life, I'd lived a quiet life. I raised my children. I just worked in graphic design, series of unremarkable jobs. And then in my late 40s, 13 years ago, I experienced a calling of the Holy Spirit in my life. And I was prompted to sense the early signs of what we now recognise as the new era of the social, the economic, the cultural unravelling that we're now seeing. And I was seeing communities abandoned, the undermining of democracy, the risk of social unrest. And I had questions about the state of the church in the UK and its capacity to make an effective Christian response. It had lost confidence and it needed help. And I felt that God was asking me to re-examine the partnership between my father and Archbishop Warlock, to look at that and to find out what the church could learn from that partnership that might be relevant for now. So that started a whole series of conversations. Eventually people joined me and Together for the Common Good emerged. And we focused on the vocation of the church in our country. And we asked, you know, what is God's mission for our time? How are we called to act? And we examined the inheritance of the church in England and the lessons to be learned. And we saw the potential of the people of God as potential catalysts for spiritual and civic renewal. And along the way, I discovered this tradition of Catholic social thought. It's a body of thinking, essentially a series of long and detailed letters, theological documents that are rooted in the gospel and in natural law, each responding to a moment of the social questions of the time. And it's actually intended as a gift to all people of goodwill. It's not meant just for Catholics. And it's emphatically not intended to be a theocracy. It's just meant to be guidance for good judgment. And the first was published as a response to the Industrial Revolution in 1891. And then since then, there have been many that have been published. Because what they were doing, they were looking at what's happening to the human person, how families and communities were impacted, beginning and during the Industrial Revolution, how they were impacted by big capital, how they were impacted by the power of money. And since then, these documents have offered this detailed theological practical guidance on everything from the family, migration, climate change, war, the dignity of work, social peace, vocation, bioethics, the economy and the church, and much more. So this is a justice tradition that's always attuned to what's happening to the human person, the natural world, families, communities. It's always asking questions, what's happening to relationships? Because that's God's primary concern. And we found this tradition offers a coherent framework that can seed and support people in the churches to work for civic and spiritual renewal. Because without something like that, you so easily get mission drift, because there's so many different interpretations. And it can seed and support us at all levels, from the grassroots right up to questions of statecraft. But the trouble with Catholic social thought is that it's not well communicated. It gets stuck at the high level. And so we noticed that hardly anybody knew about it, even in the Catholic Church. They weren't teaching it to their own people. So we kind of felt this. We were called to try and make it more accessible. And we call this common good thinking rather than Catholic social thought. And we turned it into some simple principles. And we started to develop a common good vocabulary. And we also recognised that it was really important to build an alliance, especially of Christians, to engage around this narrative of common good. This language needs to be integrated into our understanding of evangelisation as well. So we'd say that evangelisation is incomplete if it lacks a politically literate gospel rooted in an analysis of what's actually going on in the world. And this is what this tradition helps us to do. So our experience from looking at the Shepherd Borlaug Partnership and from investigating Catholic social thought and from talking to lots of people on the ground was that the church needs to become outward facing to rebuild solidarity with poor communities. Church has become very middle class over the years. Need to correct mission drift and to promote justice in an authentic Christian form. It needs to become a relational church, and I'll talk more about that later, but at all levels, personal, family, local, regional, national, international, from the character of the local church right up to matters of statecraft. And we need to build this alliance with our brothers and sisters in Christ across different denominations. Because despite our doctrinal differences, like my father and Derek Warlock, who had very different views, we can often find agreement in areas of political economy. You know, things that are happening in our world we can agree on. So we need to build this alliance, which is committed to upholding the sacred, to upholding the human space, and to restore the language of mutual obligation and reciprocity. To construct an alternative worldview to challenge the current state of affairs. So our work speaks to the heart of these issues. We engage with Christian leaders across the churches and parachurch organisations and charities who are asking questions about how the church should respond in this time of profound change, to this political moment, to poverty, to community cohesion, to the implications for ministry. Many church leaders are really in a state of some confusion and distress at this moment, where church is declining. And we do this through workshops, through sessions and talks like this, or helping leaders discern their way forward one-to-one in their communities. We accompany local church leaders to help them discern their vocation for the common good in their neighbourhood. We encourage them to create a sense of family and relationships with neighbouring institutions. But we also do it by informing and equipping leaders across the churches through public lectures and webinars. We look at public issues from this frame of Catholic social thought, like we look at the dignity of work, we look at the economy, we look at civic participation, the family, migration, people and planet, housing, the new ideologies, social peace, what it means to be human, and much more. We're trying to ground it in reality. And we invite audiences of Christian leaders across denominations to come together around a table to listen to a leading thinker and to learn in real time, to deliberate together, to chew over these things. And this helps them grow in confidence, and it builds relationships between them. And it helps to correct the problem of mission drift. We also create resources for use on the ground. We have a website full of resources, which I'll tell you about later. We also teach in a relational way. So we always do it through conversation, through partnership, by accompanying people. We especially try to work with young leaders. And another way we serve the people of the churches is through a podcast We have a transatlantic podcast called Leaving Egypt, which you might want to check out later, which addresses what it means to be God's people in these times of unravelling. So our leaders are from across the churches, from North America and the UK and beyond. And we explore the causes of our cultural and social upheaval, as well as hearing stories of how the Holy Spirit is reweaving life at the grassroots. And we also work with young people. We have a Common Good Schools programme for 11 to 16-year-olds. We train teachers to deliver it in school, and we help to position the school as a force for the common good in the neighbourhood. And the young people learn in lessons and assemblies about the principles of common good thinking. So that's just a snapshot of our work. I just wanted to give you a sense of where I'm coming from. So for the last 13 years, we've been on this creative, spirit-led journey where several integrated strands have emerged and they sort of intersect and enrich each other. Thousands of people have been involved along the years, but we're small and agile enough to experiment. So we don't ossify like a big institution, and we're not attached to any particular denomination. We're completely independent. So this is important work, and church leaders like what we're doing. In a sense, we're a bit of a disruptor in the space, but it's hard, and it's hard to fund, so we need help. We operate on a shoestring. But we always also work in partnership, which enables us to punch above our weight. We're always working with other organisations. We have a very small core team and many associates working with us on a pro bono basis. So that's me, and that's the organisation. So before we move on, we're going to look at the signs of the times in a moment. So just let you have a little breather. I'll just buzz with your neighbour for about, let's say, a minute, and then we'll come back in and we'll start looking at the signs of the times. So do have a chat with the person next to you. We're going to carry on now. So we're going to dive in now, ask the question, what's going on? Because I think a lot of us will be asking that question. We see the news, with things happening. What on earth is going on? So bear with me. We need to understand what's gone wrong before we can discern our response. So this is going to get a little dark, okay? Just bear with me. So the framework of Catholic social thought helps us to ask questions about our political economy. That means the arrangements that affect our lives, like wages, the way money is regarded, the state of the world of work, and so on. And it requires us to identify where any system is dehumanising, whether it's a system that privileges quick profit over dignity, or whether it centralises power through an impersonal state. These are some of the questions it constantly brings up. So it calls us to change and reform systems that degrade the human being, not by imposition, but by a democratic process. It's not revolutionary, it's incremental. And not by the church having power either, but through the laity. So we're to work for an economy founded on the humane treatment of workers and the dignity of work. So what do we see around us? What are the most obvious symptoms? We see that young people can't afford a home. We see that rates of marriage are declining. We see that social trust is breaking down. We see what Pope Francis calls a malign culture. Individualism, ideology, indifference, lack of meaning. And when people talk about the cost of living crisis, yes, but that isn't just isolated in the UK. And it isn't just a post-pandemic phenomenon. It's just one example of a wider crisis unfolding across the West, because its causes didn't start 10 years ago. They go back much further. So we need to zoom out and see a much bigger picture. Why do we need to do this? Because if we misunderstand what's going on, we can inadvertently prop up an unjust system, and we run the very real risk of becoming what Lenin called the useful idiots. So it's very important that we make the right call. And we have to accept, perhaps, that some of the assumptions that we carry, social, political, may be out of date. We are in a new time, a time of seismic change. And we're in a time of intense political confusion. And there are competing ideologies at work. So it's vital to ensure that we're looking at this through a Christian worldview. So just over 8 years ago, Pope Francis said, "We're not entering an era of change, but a change of era." Now, every era is characterized by a particular philosophy, and that philosophy shapes the political economy. Things are always shaped by ideas. So the animating idea of the current era that's breaking down comes from the philosophy of liberalism. And this manifests in various forms. Some of it has been very positive, but in the last 45 years or so, it's morphed into an ideology known as neoliberalism. And much further back, its roots are in the Enlightenment. But it manifested in 1979 in the form of neoclassical economics, which prioritizes shareholder interest and the pursuit of profit maximization over everything else. And this involved removing the constraints from finance capital, which ushered in 4 decades of transactional individualism and the system of globalization across the West. So we can describe this era, because it's so transactional, as an era of contract. Now, this type of economic model that this philosophy generates is inherently unstable because it's founded on a false anthropology. It's founded on a desiccated, soulless conception of the human being and a false idea of freedom. It's quite different from a Christian anthropology, where human beings are seen as transcendent, relational beings in the image of God. This is a fundamental point to recognise. It's a different anthropology. So when finance capital dominates, it has a tendency to dehumanise and commodify human beings and the natural world. It doesn't mean that money in itself is bad. It's when it's not constrained. It does generate wealth, of course, and this is important, but it tends to exploit and requires units of labour, which is us, human beings, to be cheap and mobile. So this financialisation is profoundly affecting people's lives. And in its extreme form, this philosophy conceptualises many institutions as constraints. It conceptualises the family as a constraint, tradition, where accountability and mutual obligation are seen as obstacles to progress. Even relationship to place is reframed as old-fashioned. So the insistence on having to move to find work, now that used to be right-wing. Do you remember Norman Tebbit in the 80s? It's now rebranded. Now it's freedom. So this transactional freedom, it bought prosperity for some, but it broke parts of our country. Investment moved out of certain areas, and this caused civic and spiritual degradation. It drew the brightest and best away from their places of belonging to the big cities. It was, in fact, a politics of abandonment. It was a breach of the common good. Now, governments of all parties over the last 4 decades have perpetuated this system. None have had the political vision or the courage to challenge the power of finance capital. And after 3 decades of no sign of reform of this economic system, the so-called left behind had enough of this liberal domination and mismanagement, and they literally had nothing to lose. And so their reaction was framed by big money interests as populist. But in previous eras, their reaction might well have been understood as a peasant's revolt. But this philosophy generates not only economic but social consequences. It's very important to understand it has 2 outcomes. So liberalism incorporates this idea of the unencumbered self, which produces the culture of self, emphasising rights over responsibilities, which is effectively an assault on relationship. For example, we're encouraged to outsource more and more of the things that we used to do as communities, childcare, care of the elderly, for example, generating conditions that lead to pathologies such as family breakdown, atomization, the fragmentation of communities, and spiritual confusion. And as I said before, this hyper-liberal philosophy generates a false idea of freedom. And this false anthropology involves subordinating God to self. So God should be the primary agent, and man under here. It's been inverted. That's what's happened. And every country that has followed this system is seeing the same effects. The motivation of this spirit is actually anti-human, and this is why the system is unravelling. As the older era is dying, we see multiple morbid symptoms. And we see it across multiple sectors, often regarded as disconnected, but in fact, they all stem from the same source. So we see it in low productivity, low wage, high welfare economics. We see it in extreme inequality, in massive public and private debt. We see it in the collapse of institutions, the collapse of trust. We see it in the disconnect between the managerial class and the governed. We see it in the weakening of democracy, the subordination of the local by the digital. We see it in degraded local infrastructure, in the atrophy of local forms of human association. We see it in climate warming, in the displacing of communities, in the liberalising of abortion and euthanasia, in the commercialisation of surrogacy, in the promotion of conditions needing more and more lifetime medication, in the normalising of cosmetic surgery, in organ harvesting, in sexual exploitation, in human trafficking. We see it in the erosion of social trust, in social fragmentation, in the culture wars, in the emergence of political extremes on the right and the left. And not least, we see it in symptoms of human distress, the rises in loneliness, which in fact are more prevalent among the young than the old. We see it in the rises in addiction, self-harm, depression, nihilism, and the tyranny of the social media culture, which sells a false idea of freedom and self-actualization through a competitive and dehumanising matrix of likes and image manipulation. This is what Pope Francis means by a malign culture. And he stresses that the younger generation are the most vulnerable to these cultural changes taking place. And that's because those of us who are older have a memory of something else. He says this culture is not sensitive to the needs of the poor. It reduces them to numbers. And he says it's focused on the avoidance of suffering, the exaltation of physical qualities, fear of death. And he says that virtual reality is taking over real life, eclipsing local culture. And this raises really serious concerns. It makes young people feel that they're losers. It causes frustration. It raises thoughts of suicide. It introduces illusions about the meaning of life. It causes indifference to the reality of the poor. The major cities now, we are just so used to walking past people on the street. It's just become normal. Indifference and individualism undermines the common good, the connection between human beings. So young people need help to overcome the dangers of this ideology at work. And there's actually a vicious cycle at work here that connects the economic and the social. So the dominance of banking profit promotes intensified consumerism and low wages, which in turn generates more social pathologies, which in turn leads to more the need for more welfare expenditure, which in turn requires more state redistribution, which then leads to more consumerism, which leads to more pathologies and so on. It goes round. So as this is playing out, we're beginning to see, particularly since COVID, a collaboration between the powers of finance capital and the technocratic state. And when they become too powerful, when they're unconstrained, we are effectively seeing what we might conceive of as the principalities and powers. Or in Old Testament language, they're our modern pharaohs. So in shorthand, we can call this way of seeing the world individualism, where the primacy of God is subordinated to the primacy of self, generates poverty in all its forms, economic poverty, relational poverty, spiritual poverty, leading to the breakdown of morality. And it also generates the cult of identitarian politics with its culture of self in the form of victimhood, the battle of rights, which has led to the culture wars. So in simple terms, this individualistic philosophy is hostile to human beings who are social beings. And these forms of poverty it generates, particularly in economic terms, it generates low wages, requiring a bigger and bigger welfare state subsidy. So in effect, we're subsidising big business. That's actually what's happening, because it's paying wages too low to live on. And in social terms, it generates pathologies that the state ends up trying to solve, which of course it can't. So the whole thing is utterly dysfunctional. And this anti-human system generates a toxic cycle. It increases public subsidy, increases debt, huge public and private debt. And in social terms, it's an assault on relationship. So I'm sorry to depress you, but that is actually really what is going on. But now this era of individualism and globalization, it's coming undone. The Ukraine war exposed its inherent instability and destabilized its power base. Now, there's disturbance to precarious global supply chains that caused inflation, increasing non-Western countries are forming new alliances, rejecting this Western hubris. So the old era is giving way to a new world order whose character is yet unknown. But we can already see that authoritarian, technocratic and less democratic philosophies are taking hold. So Catholic social thought not only helps us to see the problems, it also helps us to articulate solutions. It looks for a balance of power where the human being is not dominated. It requires powers of money and state to be constrained, for example, through the tax system, but also, and critically, through what they call countervailing civil society institutions, like this, like churches, like small businesses, like associations, like clubs, like football clubs, unions, guilds. This layer of civil society institutions is very important to resist the power that can dominate. And it also requires the deconcentrating of capital. Do you remember we used to have Bradford and Bingley and Northern Rock? And all of that's gone. It's all become centralised into these big behemoths of international finance capital. So Catholic social thought requires this principle called subsidiarity, which is pushing down things can be done more locally. So we'd require deconcentration of capital, regional banking, and also to renew democratic processes at regional and local levels. But not least, it also calls us to act in countercultural ways, which we're going to discuss later. It calls us, I think, to face this new era with a sense of tragic realism and to recognise at the same time the vital importance of the local, of fraternity, friendship and solidarity in order that we uphold the human. So that's us looking at the signs of the times, okay? I'd like now just to break for a little while, maybe see what the time is, 5 minutes. Have a chat with the people around you, maybe form yourselves into groups of two or three. Just reflect, what struck you by what I've just said? And particularly about how all these things are connected. Just have a little chat between yourselves for a moment.
Would anyone like to share with the whole group something that you were discussing in your smaller group?
Agree with you completely. We were just talking about the centralisation of power.
Mm.
And really local authorities have just become the implementer of central policy.
Mm.
You know, the freedom to decide what's best for your own local community is being taken away from you. Because
how do you sense that happening?
Pardon?
Where do you sense that happening?
On a local level, certainly on this island, where we have a huge civil service,
mm-hmm.
that's taken away lots of the powers of the civic bodies.
The individual
civic bodies, yes.
And there was an election, by-election in Ramsey, and it only had 18% turnout.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
And people feel, somebody said to me if she didn't vote because she didn't know the people, and I thought, for goodness sake, we live in the Isle of Man, you could go and knock on their door. We're lazy, aren't we? You know, we feel, oh well, it's not my responsibility, I don't have to do it, and I'm guilty of that too, because I often at election think, oh, I don't know who to vote for. But in the Isle of Man, we are so small, we know everybody almost. And across our churches, we know each other, and yet we have so little working together, really,
mm-hmm.
in some way. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
And across all things, everybody knows each other. They're related half the time.
We were talking about that last night, Caroline, in fact, that because we know everybody, you know, we know who our politicians are and where they've come from. And we know who their fathers were and their grandfathers. So, you know, there's that undermining of respect for those in authority, whether the authority they exercise is good or not so good, you know.
I'm interested in the distinction between what you described as the power of the civic and what you described as we don't actually do things together, as distinct from elected politicians. Think, what about this sense of agency in the local? You know, never mind voting, but what are the prospects of actually doing things together at the local level?
I think we're actually quite fortunate on the island. Mm. There is, we were just saying about distinct communities still on the island. Mm. You can go 5 miles down the road and it's another distinct community. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these communities still work really well together. You know, I mean, I've worked in the charity sector and the business world and the church.
Mm.
And often those, they can come together. But it takes vision and leadership, mm-hmm. and it takes the church to be really honest with them, with ourselves, mm-hmm. about how we view the world, the actual real world that's there, not the world that we thought was there 100 years ago. You know, it takes a lot of honesty to do that, I think.
My pen's running out. Any chance of another pen? Because this one's run out as well. Anybody else?
Well, something that I think that is happening is I think parents are opting out of bringing up their children. They now expect the people at the school to teach the children how to behave. It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we all brought up our children to be, you know, respectful of others and interested, and we taught them how to be sociable people.
Mm-hmm.
But now, everyone else seems that they all seem to expect the schools and other people to do it for them.
Yeah.
I think that's terrible.
Yeah, so
whether it's been affected, whether television has changed, maybe some of these television soaps have changed in the way they put things across. I don't actually watch. You know, what's that one that comes on every day?
Coronation Street.
I don't think you can blame television for this. It's bigger than that.
No, what do you think they've reflected what's happening on
in they
television?
They tend to reflect what's actually happening.
So
what you're describing is outsourcing.
Outsourcing, okay.
You know, the parents outsourcing the care of their children to the school. We outsource the care of the elderly to a state, to a care home.
Yes.
This is a pattern, isn't it?
Is that partly because so many people, mothers and fathers, are both working?
Yes.
And grandparents are working
as
well.
Yes.
Well, here
are women did this. Let's be real about it. Women did this for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and women no longer do it for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And have to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if they don't want to work, they have to work. You can't afford to buy a house unless you've got two high incomes.
So we're talking about the level of income. So
yes.
Low pay has quite a lot to do with this.
Absolutely. Even people that are really professional people and people in really good jobs, our house prices are so high.
But also expectations are much higher.
Yes.
I agree with you there.
Mm. Yeah. So it's a combination of high property value, low wages, outsourcing, change in the status of women. So we can see there are lots of factors
that
all come together in a perfect storm.
I'd like to know where all the money's gone.
Well, that's a very, very good question.
It's gone into the banker's pocket.
We live in one of the wealthiest parts of the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wealthier than ever before in human history.
Mm-hmm.
All this technology that was meant to make life so much easier, and we've got people queuing up for food banks.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
And like, where's the money?
In the hands of gambling, the gambling companies, all sorts of horrendous.
20% of the island's GDP is online gaming.
Percentage?
20%.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very high.
It's horrendous.
Mm-hmm. And those companies don't want to do with their money, do they?
Yeah.
And they largesse it to a few charities along the way, and we're all supposed to be hugely grateful.
So grateful.
Yeah.
But there's another point. Symptom of it, which is, you know, people who, if you're dealing with kind of the public, the amount of anger that comes to you, which is a symptom, I think, of people's frustration. I mean, just in the church, I mean, the emails we get, you know, about people wanting their children christened or to make their first communion or something, the rudeness and the anger is just,
so
it's appalling.
That's interesting. So that's probably because we've been in a culture of transactional culture, where people expect to go to the church and get something, like a customer. So they've lost the sense of reciprocity, of some mutual obligation as part of the relationship. This is what I'm talking about, the assault on relationship. Even the church itself has kind of lost that. I mean, when we, in the traditional form of church, when we go and sit in rows and we listen to somebody preaching, it's quite consumerist. We go, we get something, we go home again, as opposed to sitting in circles and all participating. So there's so much deeply embedded in the culture that people have had expectation of being able to buy stuff and then get angry when they can't get what they want. This is a fundamental shift in the nature of the culture.
I think one of the big issues of the day is centralisation.
Yeah.
We seem to have got it into our heads that we can build something bigger and better if we actually centralise it.
Yeah.
So what's happened to, say, banks on the Isle of Man,
yeah,
we're gradually moving towards a position where the only bank left will be in Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder then, will somebody in Douglas decide, well, actually, do we really need Douglas?
Yeah.
So I think the issue really is one where we saw politicians, for example, stood on the steps of the Arman Bank in Peel, crying and shouting and saying something must be done, but totally powerless to do anything. Because it's in the hands of people who sit somewhere else, and we all let it happen.
So that's a question of accountability, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do you get to those
people?
Let
other people do it to us, rather than actually maybe congregating together and doing something about it.
Yeah. Okay, that word congregate is good. You had a
just
point.
Going back
to...
Sorry,
just behind you.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Speaking of centralisation, this is thinking about what's happened in the UK. We moved here 3 years ago from Uttoxeter in Staffordshire.
Right.
Back in the day, that had big capital projects. They put their own water supply in, even bought land and built a race course.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it has a town council, which is in reality a parish council, and has an annual budget of £150,000.
Right.
All the activity that was done by the town council is now done by a borough council somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But that is only a local level of diminution of power.
Mm-hmm.
So much has now moved up to central government in the UK.
Yeah.
An example would be education, by dismantling the local education authorities and then directly funding them as trusts.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that the decision makers are so far remote from the people they are serving.
Mm-hmm.
I recently read Darren McGarvey's book, The Social Distance Between Us, and would recommend that if anybody's interested in pursuing this.
Yeah. Very good, thank you. I think we've come to the... I have one more point in a moment, but then we're going to our break. I don't want to eat into break time. But yes, that last point.
You mentioned before the great word subsidiarity.
Yes.
And I think that's... We need to look ahead to how we build change.
Exactly.
And subsidiarity is a great building block.
Yes.
Do things at a local level, at the lowest possible level.
That's right.
That's what you
That's
want.
A great point to end on. So
that was my philosophy running prisons.
Yes. So just in case people don't know what subsidiarity is about, it's basically don't do for someone else what they can do for themselves. That a central authority should not do what can be done at a local level. This doesn't mean everything should be devolved. It means you have to think carefully about what needs to be done at what level. So you think of the levels, I think of it in terms of the person, the family, the neighbourhood, the local, the regional, the national, the international. So certain things legitimately have to be done at a national level. But a lot of things don't. And I think that's, with all these points here around centralisation, it's really important. So let's all go for our break now. Have a good chat over this and we'll come back.
So just to recap after the break, I hope you had a nice break. We were talking about this unravelling, this liberalism, the unencumbered self, the removal of constraint, the identity politics, the, all that kind of stuff. And we had, I thought these were fantastic comments, actually. It's like people really understood what we were talking about. We talked about taking away the powers of the civic, the value of distinct community, it takes vision and leadership. We have little actual working together even though we know each other. People think it's not my responsibility. There's a lot of outsourcing going on. This sort of discomfort about things that are happening on the island around the some of the industries, some of the forms of employment that are going on here. We noticed a lot of the changes, structural changes, more people working, the status of women, the level of pay, low wage, high property values. We had a really interesting discussion as well around decision making, the centralisation culture versus accountability. How can we perhaps find ways back to accountability? The description of demonisation of power, very interesting. And also this comment here about the church needs to be honest about the real world. So I thought all of this was very, very helpful, brilliant conversation. So over the break, let's just take sort of 3 or 4 minutes just now. Give me more. What did you talk about over the break? Is there anything else that's come up in your conversations?
We've talked about, when I was asking somebody what mission drift, you know, I wonder, you might be expanding on that later,
yeah.
But I thought that was a really interesting concept. I don't really understand what it means.
Okay. Does anyone else want to comment on mission drift? What were you referring to in particular?
You mentioned that term a few times, mission drift. I don't really know what that means.
Okay, one of the things I was thinking about was, you know, there are lots of different forms of justice, traditions of justice, utilitarianism, libertarianism, you know, progressivism. You know, there are lots of different models of justice. And sometimes people in the churches assume they know what justice is, but actually what they're doing is they're taking some secular model of justice and then they're blessing it with a bit of theology. And what we really need to be clear about is the Christian model of justice, which is fundamentally relational, because in the Bible, and I'll talk about this later, it's fundamentally about relationship. So when we talk about mission drift, I'm thinking, for example, of, you know, I get a lot of people asking me, will you back our anti-poverty campaign? And you think, well, obviously it's a no-brainer, but I'll say, but are you making a bigger argument? And usually they're not. Usually they're just asking for a bit more in benefits. They're not arguing for fundamental reform. And I'm saying, I'm sorry, but you're not going to solve poverty by just giving people a few more quid. It doesn't change anything. We've been doing that for 40 years, and it's all got worse. Because poverty is generated by wages that are too low, right? So all you're doing is you're propping up big business more and more by increasing the size of the state. So that's what I mean by mission drift, is that it's very easy for churches and church people to get drawn off into models of justice that actually aren't Christian. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
A recent BBC Radio 4 series was talking about soup kitchens,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that we might want to support. We said, let's go and mm-hmm. help these people who are living on the street.
Mm-hmm.
But we're actually looking at the problem of, we're facilitating people living on the
exactly.
street rather than addressing the problem of why people are living
that's
on the
exactly
street.
That's exactly the same point
that.
About mission drift.
Yeah.
So we inadvertently end up propping it up.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so we got back to where we were. We had a good focus around that. When the blue tack arrives, we're going to put the first... Have you got it? Let's put... let's put this up on. So what I'm going to talk about now, and after this section, we're going to go into breakout groups. So what I'm going to say now, sort of think about it, and then you're going to take it away and talk about it together in small groups. Talking about our calling. Some people might refer to this as our vocation, you know, but what are we? What's our purpose? What's God asking us to do? So we're going to turn our attention from looking at the signs of the times to our calling as Christians. What are the implications and the opportunities for us and for our churches and for our institutions? So we talked about this being an era of unprecedented change, and throughout the West, it's not just our country. And this is an age of crisis, multiple crisis, not least in terms of climate and relationships between nations, but comes right down to crisis of relationship and so on. But to put this in ecclesial terms, I think it's true to say that Christendom is finished. And there is a book that's been doing the rounds recently called From Christendom to Apostolic Mission, written by James Shea in, 4 years ago. And he says we are at the end of Christendom. And he defines Christendom as the economic, political and social life as inspired by Christian principles. So a lot of the things that we take for granted actually have come from Christianity. And we've lived with it for centuries. It's become the sea that we swim in. But if you don't water the roots, you have what they call cut flower syndrome. And you'll live with the benefits of the legacy for some time, but then over time, if it's not nourished, the flower will wilt and die. So Christendom is over, and we are seeing the beginnings of that cultural and covenantal breakdown. We're seeing this culture that's sort of scarred by this individualism and so on. And there is a vacuum where political leadership ought to be. So we're not going to get the guidance or the leadership we need from political leaders. It's just not there. And there's great uncertainty about the future. But as Christians, we're not gloomy and we're not despondent. In fact, these are great and wonderful days to be alive, because we know that amidst all of this crisis, God is at work. And so this is the time when, as God's people, we find ourselves in increasing opposition to the world and yet called to live abundantly within it. And this position of opposition, it can and should be a joyous opportunity to do as Jesus did and to participate in God's great creative participation in the way that we live. It's much more to do with our behaviours and how we live. So what is the church's mission here? What's an authentically Christian response going to look like? So there are opportunities, even in this dark time, to be a blessing on our culture, to bring to life again the quality and the character of the infant church as described in the Acts of the Apostles. There are roles for God's people to play in spiritual and civic renewal. We do have a story that's more compelling than individual autonomy, more meaningful than power and wealth, more beautiful than the cult of self. All around us, people are desperate for meaning. And our tradition does have answers. We have a story of justice, truth, beauty, and communion. A story that gives us the authority to reject the temptations of the power of inhuman systems, the dull compulsion of markets, the commodification of human beings and the natural world. So there is a work to be done. And this work is about restoring community, about solidarity with poor communities, about defining and defending the place of the family in society, about protecting the innocence of children. It's about standing up for humanity, preserving the human space, defending the sacred. It's all about good business practices. It's about just and covenantal relationships. It's about trust, responsibility, mutual obligation and belonging. It's about what it means to be human. And this might sound like nice rhetoric, but actually the times are such that it's going to become quite hard-edged because all of these things are under threat. So at the level of statecraft, we're also, as lay people, we're called to propose a political economy that is consistent with our tradition. And that means, as we described earlier, decentralising banks and energy providers. It means that subsidiarity piece we were talking about. It means the dignity of work. It means insisting on work. We must not capitulate to a workless future. I mean, I think it's horrific. We've got 5.5 million people on out-of-work benefits in this country. You know, did you know that? I mean, it's quite a figure. You know, people abandoned, basically. So it means investment in jobs and skills and in the abandoned places. It means distributing power and assets. It means enabling that layer of civil society institutions to make them healthier. because that's how we resist this dominance of state power and capital power. It means building a common good between capital and labour. We're achieving that balance so one is not dominating the other. But to do this work, we've got to reject the false promises of the political ideologies of both collectivism and individualism. So we're getting some governments now, for example, really trying to achieve things out with the democratic process. You referred to that earlier in the local. It's happening at national level and international level. That people, this is why people are feeling powerless, because decisions are being taken that haven't gone... There's no mandate for them. So we've got to reject that sense of technocracy, but also reject this philosophy of individualism. So we do this by building common good between us. And we start whatever situation we're in by seeking first the kingdom of God. Now, we can talk about what that means, what we think it means. Whether we're in a business environment or a school or a church or a neighbourhood group, what does the kingdom look like? It means living God's economy and cultivating relationships of loving friendship with our neighbours, building common good across class, across opinion. That's very countercultural now, because everybody is dividing up into separate opinion groups. So this is something the church really can do. So building across class, across opinion, across race and ethnicity, across sex, across age, and across educational background. Not just the popular, fashionable way of doing this is race and gender. That is so narrow. We need to be much broader than that. You know, diversity of opinion, class, education. We are called to be prophetic here, to be countercultural and to resist what we might call structures of sin. John Paul II would call structures of sin. And we're called to build structures of grace. So before we go into small groups, let's just look a bit more at the challenges and opportunities facing us. So the greatest challenge to the church is always the challenge to faithfulness and steadfastness in belief. And of course, with this comes the great temptation for the church to look to the world and to imitate the world, rather than to provide a witness as prophetic leaven in the world. And the church has always been tempted by the zeitgeist, and it's no different today. So let's remember that although many of the churches are declining, there is actually growth. Globally, the church is growing. Pentecostal and Catholic numbers are growing globally. But those figures, of course, don't represent growth across every nation. And of course, while there are pockets of growth, even in our country, usually around some of the Pentecostal, non-denominational evangelical groups, there is a picture of quite dramatic decline and collapse in our historically Christian countries. And in many parts of the country, churches are only propped up where there's large migration, for example, Polish immigrants or so on. Christendom is dead. So it's asking for a new wave, new energy. And this is why we, in our podcast, we're really interested in stories about how the Holy Spirit is working in the local, because new forms are emerging. So we're on something of a transition about where we are as church. And of course, there are efforts to push the church further and further into the private domain, out of the public square. There's amalgamation, there's closure of churches, there's the loss of Christian presence in places. And when we have that loss of that sacred space, we have a loss of relationship with place. We lost our place on the map. So we are seeing this loss of confidence and mission drift and confusion, even within the churches, around how to be church, division around what evangelization means, whether it means proclaiming the gospel or living the gospel. It's not either or, it's both. But these confusions take their toll. But the big questions in life have not gone away. In fact, they're intensifying. People are desperate for a life of meaning. And our faith has answers to these questions. So there is a need for a church that can speak into our culture, that's seen to be a blessing on our culture, that brings to life the Acts of the Apostles. So our Christian tradition has a narrative that is more desirable and necessary than power and wealth, than the purposeless cult of self. And there are vital roles that we have to play in civic and spiritual renewal. So one of those things is about language. And there are opportunities to speak about the significance and importance of human existence and not to be shy about talking about our God-given identity, to counter the identity politics that divides human beings, this false anthropology we were talking about, that denies our transcendent nature, that makes us vulnerable to domination, that undermines the common good. So language is important. We have that language of the sacred that upholds what it means to be human from natural conception until natural death. I know you're facing a big question here about euthanasia on the island. So what does it mean to care for each other? What does it mean to assert that we are relational beings, not isolated individuals? This language causes us to talk about covenant, about relationship, solidarity, mutuality, to build back relationship where it's been lost. Systems which have become unhuman or anti-human, and how to build relationships between institutions. And where there's the tyranny of over-centralised wealth and power, that we need to call that out. So there are opportunities to promote the notion of the common good and opportunities to be prophetic, to be countercultural. And these opportunities offer an antidote. So what's needed is this common good narrative of hope and justice that resists this dull, dehumanising story. And Christian business leaders can actually do this too. They can call out inhumane systems of profit and power. They can insist on relationship being built back into processes of commerce. For example, you know, think about the self-checkout. You know, every time you go to Tesco now, they sort of force you not to see a human being. You know, do we have to capitulate to that? Whose bright idea was that? You know, yeah, where's the money gone? Where's the money gone? So whether it's about making a virtue of local face-to-face commerce or whether it's rehumanising bureaucratic processes in public services, how do you build back a human connection? And business leaders also can generate a vocabulary of the common good about mutuality. For example, workers on boards, you know, building a relationship between management and unions. Within Catholic social thought, unions are important. They're respected because they're forms of association. So as long as it's not abused, you know, the idea is that people shouldn't be isolated individuals. They should be doing things in association. So in terms of challenge, there is massive mission drift risk, as we said, to Christian institutions in terms of identity and purpose. But it's also an opportunity. So we need to be serious about our institutions, our Christian institutions, not to be shy about it. There needs to be places where prayer happens and where being a visible Christian is acceptable. And I know there are issues in your parliament about this now. So in the wider reality, Christian institutions and businesses can build coalitions and alliances with like-minded institutions and other religious organisations. You may find yourself in relationship with unfamiliar partners, but you might find that there are things that you agree on. That's important, to look out for those kinds of allies orientated towards spiritual and civic renewal. So I'm just wanting us to, for a moment, go into small groups and think particularly about the opportunities in commercial, business and public institutional life for the moment. We're going to talk about personal and relation and local later. So just now, I'd like to think about commercial life, business life, institutional life, public services. And think about where do you notice things in those sectors becoming less relevant?
Right, how did you get on in your groups? Who would like to start off and share what you're talking about? Remember, this is a focus on the positive.
I know that lots of you were complaining about this and that, and we all know there are lots of things wrong, but the question was, can you think of ways of influencing a more relational, rehumanising way of doing things in commerce, business and public institutions. So if you can please put aside your critique, because I agree with you.
What ideas did you come up with?
Yeah, well, I think one of the conclusions was the importance of talking to people, eyeballing them,
yes,
and spending time with them.
That sounds, this is one of my bugbears. This kind of thing sounds really innocuous, doesn't it?
Mm.
It's actually really, it's the work.
Mm.
Making contact with people, establishing human connection is the work. So don't let anybody make you feel that somehow it's trivial.
But they do, don't they?
They do.
But in this connection, we've lost total touch with our bank. In a human form.
Yes.
I've got a password,
mm-hmm.
and they've got my voice on top.
So what's your solution for rehumanizing?
Well, bring back some managers that you can talk to.
So human beings.
Yes, human beings.
And we also mentioned on that particular point, David was too modest to mention it, but the gentleman at the back there has set up a Manx Credit Union.
Ah.
It took him 2 or 3 years of persistent persuading government to set up. We haven't got the legislation over here at first, so he's done all that, and it's helping hundreds of people.
Amazing. That's really fantastic. And that's exactly what the whole country needs.
There's a company on the Isle of Man responsible for the software that deals with postcodes.
Oh, yeah.
They
yeah.
give away their profits.
The Doric Cross.
And it's huge. They bought a plane this last autumn for Mission Aviation Fellowship. It's the second plane they've bought in the last, 15, 20 years.
For $3 million.
And members of staff can nominate the charities that they would like money to go to, and then they have this like gala.
What's the name of the company?
AFD. AFD software, and they give the money away. All, you know, everything that they don't need to operate the company goes.
Okay, so that
their name is the Doricots.
So that's a philanthropic model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. They make money in their business, and then they give some money
and
away.
They give most of it away.
Okay, so that's. That's one thing. I'm actually talking about rehumanising the actual way we do things.
Right.
Because, and I'm not criticising it, but if you think of a wealthy person makes their money and then gives money to charity at arm's length, they're not actually engaging in relationship.
Yep.
What common good is about building relationship.
Although, to be fair, this particular group do build relationships with the charities that
okay, so that's both and. That's even better.
And they have a big get-together every year when the charities come that are being given.
Okay,
and
so that's...
a huge brochure about it all.
That's not everyday relationship. That's a big business saying, look at the great stuff we do and celebrating people. What we're looking for is something systemic on a daily basis.
Shop locally.
Yeah.
Don't use Amazon.
Yeah.
Okay. Any more, please? And go into your bank. If you're lucky enough to have a bank, go in every week, as I do in Ramsey. Change banks. Go to one that's there. I know Peel is terrible. You haven't got anything. But use it. If we don't use it, and talk to people. And yeah.
What about public institutions? What about... Did any of you talk about that? You know,
talk about sewage. In Peel, we don't have any proper sewage disposal. And they've been talking about it for more than 20 years. Plus.
So and it still doesn't everyone happen. Has septic tanks?
No.
Discharged into the sea.
Raw, untreated sewage goes into the sea.
Okay. And we've been talking and talking and pushing and driving. And it looks as though they have now at least identified a site.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's been given planning permission yet.
Well, why is that held up? Whereas in Ramsey it happened, because that used to happen in Ramsey, and they built them.
Because Peel didn't like the idea of what was being suggested.
So we are decentralised in lots of things, aren't we? That lots of things do happen more locally in the Isle of Man.
I would expect that as compared with some of the bigger urban cities on the mainland. I would expect that you have held on to some of these precious practices. In, you know, some people say, oh, the Isle of Man is sort of like going back to the 1950s, it's backward.
But I've said to them, well, surely they've held on to some of the things that we've lost that we shouldn't have lost. Yeah. So in some ways you're ahead of the rest of the country because you've held on to things that matter, right? Mm. So I think we should really value those things. Mm. And where you see it being eroded, really stop it. Yeah.
The Isle of Man is still email driven, mm-hmm. even within churches, within businesses, within that.
Right.
You know, everything is send an email, don't talk to me, send me an email.
Okay, so the culture of the digital culture versus the...
And that's been for a long
time. So can you see a way of... Can you actually see a practical way of challenging
from
that?
From top level management, encouraging people to meet together within the organisation to actually meet face to face.
I think to actually reverse the trend of emails is every time we get an email, apart from the spam, just pick a phone up and dial someone in to speak to them.
Yeah.
Take the initiative to actually speak to them.
So I think that's really helpful. The helpful part is when you said top management would encourage, because somebody has to do something. We've talked earlier about vision and leadership, and sometimes it's as simple as that, of convincing management level people of what's going on that we've discussed today. And there are small incremental things that you could do in your management position that could really make a big difference to change the culture in your company.
I think banning mobile phones when you're with somebody.
Well, isn't that interesting that people laugh, right?
Well, they laugh because I know I don't use one. And they all wish I did. And I'm always frustrated when I'm with somebody and it bleeps and they're like this.
But I find it interesting how increasingly young people that I know are finding the tyranny of social media and checking really annoying and beginning to find it sort of existentially troubling. Mm-hmm. And some of them are actually stopping it. And they're just saying, I'm taking a break, you know, I'm taking a whole weekend out, or I'm going to buy a different phone because I don't want to live in this smartphone world. And there's an American psychologist called Jonathan Haidt, whose work I like a lot, and he's recently done really, very detailed research on the impact of the smartphone on children, dating from 2010. And it's absolutely incontrovertible that the smartphone is rewiring children's brains. And he's now saying, he's lobbying American government, saying, you've got to ban this for under 13s. Mm-hmm. It's that serious. And that leads to all the other sort of unravelling of the mental health issues that we see around, particularly young girls, for example. So this is actually, these are not trivial things. You know.
But it's the good use of things, isn't
yes.
it? You know, I
yes.
do not want to give up my mobile phone, and I have the Manx Bible. And on a Sunday morning, I follow on the Manx Bible. You know what I mean? That's just one example.
Yes.
So...
Yes.
I think, again, not throwing out the baby with the bathwater,
yeah.
but I totally agree, under 5 shouldn't be allowed anywhere near any kind of
yeah.
digital thing. That's my
yeah.
personal
yeah.
opinion. Yeah. Under 5. No,
that's very helpful. The good use of tech.
Yes.
And when we say the good use, that's underpinned by a set of principles. And that's, again, where our Christian tradition can actually help us. You know, what? Again, our anthropology. We are relational beings, we're transcendent beings, we're in relationship with God and with each other. What does that then, what would then the good use of tech require?
Mm.
So it's got to be anchored in something that we believe in.
And not making assumptions about what that good is. And
exactly.
I think that's
exactly.
where we have those conversations, isn't it? Because people, you know, what I think might be good might not be what someone else. And so actually we need to have the conversations about what
yeah.
is... good use.
So, deliberation around what is good.
There's an issue about how we relate to public institutions, and I think particularly
yeah.
government.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm reflecting on is, up until a few years ago, our ferry company was owned by venture capitalists.
Right.
And the government then essentially bought it. So it's not state-owned, it's a company at arm's length.
Right.
But vast amounts of criticism, and we could argue the rights and wrongs of decisions taken, but we've got a gas company that you can't speak to anybody on the island now about your gas.
Mm-hmm.
They've utterly dehumanised it. Again,
mm-hmm.
it'll be a venture capitalist company. And
mm-hmm.
where does public ownership sit in this debate? And how might we encourage where that step has been taken? I see a lot of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Do we actually need to affirm politicians others' rights for the things we think they're doing well.
Yeah.
And not just criticise what we don't like. I think is where I'm getting to.
No, we picked up on a similar point, David, about the almost the loss of confidence by the Max government. You know, the endless consultations, going out. These so-called arm's length companies, not just for the steam packet, but for Manx Care or our entire health service. You know, so a politician in the Department of Health could say, "Oh, that's a matter for Manx Care." Mm-hmm. You know, not for us politicians. It's an operational matter,
okay.
And that is a useful divorce, if you like, for them at that point. But there's this. Manx Development Corporation set up, you know, to create the Westmorland Village. This is done by statute, you know, and so you've got the government almost distancing itself from the people.
So that point reflects also what we were saying earlier about this kind of unholy marriage now between technocratic government and big capital.
Mm.
It's a similar sort of thing. So you're saying that, I think I'm hearing you say, that local politicians are sort of saying, "Well, that's too big a deal for us because that's an issue for that company to sort out," and in a sense they're being intimidated. That issues that relate to international investment, let's say, is somehow over their heads. And this is what's happening: is that local democracy is being kind of put into second place from big corporate interests. That's happening everywhere, and this is what we have to resist. So part of it starts with a conversation like this, where you start to recognise what's going on, and then, as someone said, to support your local politicians and say, "Look, we see what's happening. We want to support you. We want you to represent us. We don't like the trend, the direction this is travelling in. You know, we need to hold more of our agency." So this word agency constantly comes back to me. You know, I actually think people have sort of forgotten what it means. You know, what does it feel like to have local power between you and your neighbours? You know, as opposed to giving it away or allowing it to be taken.
So we're going to move on now. I think I'm just really inspired by the level of your engagement and your conversation. It's fantastic. I need a volunteer reader.
Just to read Jeremiah 29:7. Who would like to read that for me?
Yes, okay. You can stay where you are if you like. Can you read it from where you are?
Okay.
So just to give a bit of context, we've just been looking at the commercial, business and public institutions angle of things, and now we're going to turn to the personal and the local. So I just thought we could have, you know, maybe take 10 seconds of silence, and then we're going to have this read for us, and then we'll take another, say, 30 seconds of silence just to sit with this reading.
Seek the peace of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its peace, you will find your peace. Jeremiah 29, verse 7.
So now we're going to contemplate the opportunities to become more relational personally, in terms of leadership, and locally, in terms of our churches, schools, and local Christian groups. And we can see here how Jeremiah sets it out. He describes what it might mean for God's people to live in this time of unravelling. And it's about building common good. It's about a shared life, friendship with God and with each other. And as some of you have said, we need local leaders. We need vision and leadership. People who can put personal spirituality and vocational responsibility at the service of the common good. And so we need to nurture those leaders. People who are humble, who understand the Beatitudes, who understand that the places where people work and live are as important as the work they do and how they live. Place is important. We need leaders who can see the face of Christ in the neighbour, who are attuned to discovering the sacred in the ordinary. Because God is at work. Who can assert a Christian identity fundamentally rooted in God and the gospel. An identity that is relational, which prioritises the building of relationships of trust and reciprocity over everything else. And so we need our churches, schools and other Christian groups to become more intentional, intentionally relational, through building local partnerships, by teaching young people the importance of relationship, mutual responsibility, by committing to the life of the local in the neighbourhood, in ways that strengthen our civic ecology. Now, as we said, you here in the Isle of Man probably have, you know, a great deal more of this than the majority on the mainland. So I want to encourage you how important that is and to hold on to it. And we also need to recognise the point about honesty was really important earlier. As the church, we need to be honest that many churches have fallen out of relationship with poor people. The middle class church issue is very significant. And we do need to find ways of learning to live in solidarity with the poorest in our communities. And that might mean changing the way we do things. So many churches say to me, oh, we want to improve our engagement. We want to serve the poor. And they talk about outreach. And as soon as they say that, I just know they haven't got the relationships. Because they wouldn't use that word if they already were in relationship with them. And what's happened is over time, they've fallen into a transactional mindset where they've become service providers, serving clients, or rescuers, rescuing victims. This is not what Jesus asked. We're meant to be neighbours and friends, acting in reciprocity, mutual respect. Jesus says, I've called you friends. And so this is about recovering the practice of friendship. The Good Samaritan, good example. A bit cliched, but really when you get deep into it, this is a very good model. So he didn't leave it to others to deal with. He didn't outsource it. He did it personally. And put himself out in doing so, took some risk. So in our own time, I think this means not outsourcing to the council or to the state. He was able to connect with a man in trouble who was not part of his social circle and walk with him. And Pope Francis is very insistent on this. Every year he publishes a letter called World Day of the Poor Letter. And in it, he keeps on saying, stop outsourcing. He wants us to become personally involved because he recognises this culture of indifference and distance that has arisen. But he says, we must emphasise that the rights that every poor person has must be held in balance with responsibility. And so they must be involved in their path back if they've become peripheral to the path back. And so they must be involved in an active process of change and responsibility. And this element of relationship runs right through the themes of biblical justice. I just want to share with you, I'm working, one of the projects we're doing at the moment is fascinating, working with an Orthodox Jewish scholar who is an expert on the Torah, and in particular, the elements of the Torah that relate to economy. And one of many fascinating things he's taught me is the word lending means accompaniment. So if you think about it, Where have we got to now? You know, when we loan, we get a loan from a bank. It's all online, it's all digital and so on. In God's economy, if you're having a hard time, I'm meant to walk in relationship with you. I'm meant to accompany you until you get back on your feet, for as long as it takes. That might mean helping you get another job, or supporting you financially, or supporting you with moral support, bringing other people around. It's meant to be relational. This is radically different from where we've ended up. And you start thinking about this, about the whole economy, it sort of blows your mind about how far we've got away from God's idea of justice. So it's not about giving someone cash and leaving them alone. So when you think of those 5.5 million people on out-of-work benefits, the state isn't accompanying them. Can't do that. It's not the job of the state. But many of those people have been sort of parked and have become discarded, not needed. We have a government that prefers to bring in many immigrants to take up the low-paid work rather than retrain our own people. This is actually quite dangerous for social peace. So Christian social justice tradition is anchored in God's economy of mutual obligation and right relationship. And so to resist this dehumanising culture, we're called to be non-tribal and to make connections with people outside our social circles, especially across socioeconomic lines. Because this is how we find harmony, and this is how the community can feel itself. And again, sadly, you know, it's very true in the churches there is a lot of tribalism. You know, we're not immune from this. So we really ought to be very vigilant about that. So yes, it's all about building the kingdom of God where we are. So it's less about handouts, less about activism, less about projects, more about relationship. And I would say, you know, the average age here is older. Don't feel you aren't equipped because you're older. In fact, the reverse is true. Because the older you are, the more of a memory you have of how to build relationships and to be a good neighbour. So it's actually an advantage. And the spotlight here, again, Pope Francis is putting the spotlight on ordinary next door neighbours as opposed to the professional community worker. Because again, as churches, we've kind of outsourced it. You know, we raise a bit of money in our parish to pay the community worker, then we don't have to do it. But we're all meant to be doing it. And in this reciprocity way, not just we're the benevolent types that are helping the poor people over there. Actually, Pope Francis says the church needs to be evangelised by the poor. Because there's something that people who are poor know that we don't know, which is the need for each other and for God, more instinctively than the busy and the affluent often forget. So in practical terms, and I know some of you are involved in these things, we can create places where people feel welcome, places of encounter, physical places people can come together, invite people, intentionally invite people. We could make food banks places of encounter, not just distribution points. Because ultimately, we're not going to get rid of them overnight. We've got to have a vision of really working against them. But in the meantime, how can we make them more relational? Being aware of things like, you know, is there maybe a poor person died in the area where you live? Do you know that? Did anybody help to make sure they got a decent burial? Is your parish or your church the kind of church that would be welcoming to an ex-offender and his family? It's a bit challenging, isn't it? We need to be looking for opportunities where everything becomes an occasion for communion. And we also need to be looking out for opportunities for alliances and partnerships, especially with people you wouldn't normally come into contact with. Again, you may find you have a common mind on one particular issue and you disagree violently on other things. This is important. That's a common good. So there is this work to be done, and it involves us all. And it's a mission that's not only of value to rebuild the confidence of a bruised and vulnerable church, but it's also of value to the whole of society. And that work is about restoring the language of community. It's about a reweaving of that which has been separated. So it's about how we speak about each other It's about the place of the family. It's about how we rebuild trust. Again, relationships, relationships, all the time. So as Christians, we need to, as we said before, have this sense of what is the kingdom. What are the elements of the kingdom? Where people care for each other. What's covenantal about that? It's really worth spending time thinking about that. What does it mean for you where you are? And also, I think through our churches, through our schools, through our Christian groups, through our bodies that we're involved with, we have to bring in the language of forgiveness and redemption. Because this identity politics that we're stuck with is totally unforgiving. This cancellation culture is very powerful. And it's having this terrible chilling effect on the whole of society. People feel afraid to talk. And if you're afraid to talk, the common good is vastly undermined. You cannot, we've said before how important deliberation is. Working things out together, negotiating across hard differences. So if we can't talk, we make ourselves far more vulnerable to domination from above. So forgiveness and redemption is vital. People should be able to feel free to speak their mind without fear of being rejected. So this is forgiveness and redemption, not just in religious terms, but in human terms, to offer a way back into society again for people who've become peripheral because perhaps of things they've done or said or because of what's been done to them. So every human being is worthy of love and affection. And there's also a need to not only to offer to pray for people. Often that happens, you know, in social action, church social action. People say, would you like me to pray for you? I would say it's also important to teach people how to pray, to give them that power. There are often assumptions that people know this, but they don't anymore. And so we need to open up the great, beautiful traditions of Christian spirituality, Ignatian, Celtic spirituality, which I know you have here, and empower people to have their own conversation with God, to show them that God really wants to be in relationship with them, wants to hear their voice. So there's no question that we're entering a dark time. The symptoms, the pathologies are vast and connected. And for the church, it might feel like it's all over. But we know that God is at work, and so we're not despondent. It's just a different way of operating. So it does require a new mindset. And if we listen, we'll see that God is doing something profound. And he's actually preparing us to send us out. So the church is no longer host, it's neighbour. See the difference in dynamic? So in the neighbourhood, the church, whether it's a group of people, whether it's a building, whatever form it takes, its posture, its relational posture, is as a neighbour, rather than saying, well, we've got it all sewn up, why don't you come and join us in our lovely party over here? It's not a private club. So it's a really big change that's going on. And this is what is meant by the shift from Christendom to apostolic mission. So fundamentally, it's about becoming more attentive to what God is doing. And I know many of you here are interested in discernment practices and listening. That's exactly where we need to be. But listening in the neighbourhood, listening not just on our own, in the comfort of our own homes, but listening to what's happening among the people that we share life with. And this is sort of calling us into participation in this reweaving of our common life. So I would encourage you now to talk in little groups again around this notion of reweaving. What does that mean to you? What's it kind of suggest to you? Where you live and where you work.
Right, let's go back to this question then. The reweaving, how did your conversations go?
I think one of the really important things is how we treat people who are in the community in our fellowships. For example, if we have a prayer meeting and invariably it involves praying for missionaries or clergy or people like that, whereas in reality we ought to be saying, who is our local school teacher, headmaster, police sergeant, and so on and so forth. I'm just going back to ideas of Mike's prayer. Every day we pray for something specific in the community, but we name the person. And it's surprising when you actually meet that person, what a difference it makes to actually the conversation that takes place. So if you're praying, for example, for about your local political leaders, rather than speaking negatively about them all the time, it's amazing what will happen. But next time you meet your image care, you may not have a lot to say to them, but actually, you do actually slip in that, oh, by the way, our little group is praying for you. Just watch the reaction on their faces, because they're not used to that. They're used to people always having a go at them. So actually say you're actually praying for them. You don't need to say anything else. Let them take the conversation up if they want to. I think the other thing too we didn't probably mention is the what dehumanises or will do is the use of AI in the community. And how that gradually... We're miles behind in the church, even thinking about the implications of that, whereas in education, business, they're all into this now. My wife works for the Open University, and the discussion there is not how we're going to use it, it's how we use it, and how quickly can we get into using AI in higher education. So we've got to be really thinking about this, and how are we actually going to get into it and somehow do the things that you're talking about, actually being influencers rather than just recipients of whatever
the
throw us.
Absolutely, that's great. How to be influencers rather than recipients.
How to humanise AI.
Well, as we know, I mean, some of the leading developers in AI are so concerned about it, they're even advocating shutting it down completely.
Why are we saying we've got to have it? The actual people.
And again, this has been happening without any mandate, not being consulted, it's suddenly becoming a reality.
And now we all think, oh, the next new thing, let's see what we do with this, but we don't have it.
Yeah, and we are being groomed, so all the time being shown how brilliant it is and what it can do for us. So it's this question, again, about how the good use of tech and how we need to be anchored in our own tradition, in our own worldview, understanding of what human being is, correct anthropology, and from there we make good judgment. Anybody else on this side?
Can I just say, just the word influencers.
Yeah.
One of my granddaughters was recently invited to go to Birmingham with about 80 other young people from within the Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm.
And they were invited because they were influencers. Now, what happens with that information that was received is another question. But at least they had ownership. They've got ownership of whatever is decided.
And where do they get their information from?
From peers. From.
So again, as a grandfather of those grandchildren. It's part of your responsibility
to
make sure that they are anchored in a set of good principles.
Yeah. I used last night in the conversation we had, I used the word, our vocation for Kath and me at this stage in life is towards our grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
That's our vocation. So, and I think we need a lot more vocation in all areas of life.
Yeah. What does vocation mean here?
It's a calling.
Drawing on your relationship
with God
to influence others. And particularly the young. Yes, you were going to say something.
I was going to say, we talked about at the cathedral, on a Monday, they have the big table, which is an open table. Anyone can come, get a very nice three-course meal, and they're just given a brown envelope. They can put in nothing or whatever they feel like.
Yeah.
And that is a very good outreach.
Yeah.
And they can also take away meals.
So the key, we were talking about this last night, the key point about that is, are the volunteers in relationship with the visitors?
Well, I think some people come and just talk.
Mm-hmm.
like Eric.
You see what I'm saying? Is the church, rather than being the host,
yes,
needs to have this reciprocal arrangement.
But it does, really, because quite a few of the volunteers are not members of the church.
Sounds good.
And some of the people who come and eat are members of the church,
right,
and some are not. So I would say it is fairly reciprocal.
Yes.
So I would say that comes under Ministry of Food.
Yes.
And so we're saying reciprocity is part of that.
Yes.
There's a great... I heard you speaking something about food. Did I hear that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I said that I thought that eating together was a very spiritual activity, and that is one way that we can encourage.
Yeah.
Here's how Alpha started.
Yes, I was thinking about it. You know, there is something levelling about actually sitting down and eating together. And
I have a lovely story of a pastor I know in South London. It's fairly typical of many pastors, the moment you felt a failure, that his congregation wasn't growing, it was an older demographic, you know, my whole ministry had been a waste of time and so on. And then he prayed and he felt the Holy Spirit was calling him to invite people from the community who were not part of the church to join him for a meal. And he said to his congregation of 35, I think it was, "This is what I want to do, but I need to do this without you. Is that okay? You're banned." they said, okay. And he said, "Would you pray for it?" And they said, yes. So he went, he invited six people, none of whom came to church, none of them had a prayer practice, but he knew them. He was very good at talking to people in the community. And he said to them, "Would you join me on Thursday night? It's sort of church, but not really." He said, "We're going to eat." He said, "But I'm not cooking for you, and I'm not shopping, and I'm not washing up. How does that sound?" And they all said, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So they all came together and made a roast dinner together. They sat and ate together. And in that conversation, it was just a very easy conversation, but he said he dropped in there, "If you've got anything bothering you, any concerns," he said, "just write it down on a piece of paper, put it in this box in the middle of the table, and we'll call that prayer. We'll give it to God."
Mm-hmm.
And that was their introduction to prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Did you not like use any scripture?" And then he said, "A couple of lines from the Attitudes provoked a fantastic conversation." He's from a working class background himself in Stockton-on-Tees, so he knows how to talk to people. And then what happened was, they said, "Can we do this again?" So they did it again the next week, and then the next week. And they said, "Could we bring our, you know..." They started bringing their family and friends. And over 6 months, it grew to 100 people.
Oh. Wow.
And they had to move to the church hall. They had to rejig the way they did the cooking. This was all before COVID, of course. COVID affected everything. But it completely changed his attitude to leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And there are stories like this. And it's about lowering the barrier to entry. Because those people would never, a million years, stepped over the threshold of the church. But they had baptisms, they had people come into faith. So we've got to be creative and learn from other styles of church to see, you know, what are we missing out on? How can we build this occasion for communion? Were there any other... Yeah.
Sort of on that, of getting together with food, but
yeah.
Many years ago, when I was a young student, we had a gathering for children off the streets on probation, etc.
Mm.
Gave tea, but they made tea with us and
mm.
games.
Mm.
And in the health, you know, situation in schools, the food system, you know, for children, I always think if churches, WI, schools could use their kitchens with people older who remember how to cook from scratch.
Yeah.
And could teach children, because I've seen it done as well in a school in Leicester many years ago, with primary school, whose parents were at the door that day, you know, waiting for their tea. And they'd give the recipe to them. The children knew how to do it from scratch, curries, quiches, pastry, the lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents were like, "What have you done today?" Because they knew they were going to have a good tea.
Yeah.
And it's like children can be taught, or young people, in kitchens, not just come to a meeting and let's entertain you and let's occupy you, let's make it, you know, what you get in school anyway, in youth clubs. Let's do some skills around food, which is creating a home environment anyway, a nurturing environment. And that would, you know, hit the deprivation out of the ballpark, you know.
I think that's brilliant. Because it ticks so many boxes.
Level.
Yeah. it ticks the building competence, the building relationship. It's fun, it's nourishing, it's healthy. They have something that they can carry with them. It's transferable skill. So many good things about that. And that you talked about three different institutions working together. This kind of triangulation is very important. This is part of the Catholic social teaching vision of society, is that layer of civil society where, you know, some parts of the country, it's so thin, it's so atrophied, there's almost nothing left. So it's actually really important that we build these practical partnerships. Where we do, money doesn't need to change hands. In fact, sometimes it's better if it doesn't. So building trust, what Pope Benedict used to call a gift economy.
And there are sort of unused facilities around, you know, they might be used once a week in a church or in a school, you know, and in the holidays, you know, school holidays, they fund many, many kitchens in schools to be used.
I always thought during COVID, you know, when so many churches couldn't open because the volunteers were too old, so why aren't they asking the neighbours? Why don't we reach out to the neighbourhood and say, this is your church, you know, your grandparents probably built this, but we don't have the people, could you help us? The church is often too afraid, you know, think, well, health and safety and danger.
Why don't we do it? Because health and safety, safeguarding, all these...
But this, we can't be cowed by this.
No.
You have to have a really clear idea of what needs to happen and then find ways to achieve it, not be put down. Any other thoughts around this? How would personal reweaving or leadership, what kind of leadership do we need? How can the church and the school or small Christian groups play their part in this reweaving?
I said before about praying for people involved in church or in professions, but in actual fact we should be encouraging each other to get involved. And we talked about local authority work. There are always vacancies for local commissioners around the island and councillors, and we shouldn't be afraid of putting our names. Or it may not suit everybody, but I think everybody should have a go at being a commissioner if they feel they've got a reasonable amount of common sense. So I think just getting involved, but then actually praying for them in that position, not leave them
on their own.
And that's what we can do. But we're usually pretty good at praying for other people, so we should be praying for all our people who are involved in these positions, because we actually encourage them to get into it.
And say we're going to support you.
That will actually open up a huge amount of doors.
Yeah. Thank you. That's great. Yes.
I was really struck by what you said about helping people to pray themselves. And that the box on the table where they put their requests in, gave them to God. As simple as that. And I'm aware that... you know, I can say to someone, would you like me to pray for you? But I've never thought really, and how about you? You know, would you like
can I help
to pray?
You to pray?
Can I help you?
Yeah,
know,
let's do it together.
Would you like to be able to pray for yourself? You know.
Well, let's do it together.
Well, let's do it together. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or will you pray for me?
Yeah.
Yes.
But it's not for people that don't, you know.
It's a bit like stabilizers on a bike, isn't it? You might need a little try. Whether you're doing it first and then encouraging them to do it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not to leave them on their own, to say, let's do this together.
Yeah.
I've always been struck that the Our Father, there's no I in it, there's no me in it, it's all us. Mm-hmm. The language is all of us together.
I don't know the answer to this question really, but it's how can we start coming back to the model of being disciples together that Jesus showed us.
Yeah.
Because some parts of the church, not all obviously, have gone so far away from community.
Yeah.
And Tim Chester's written a book called A Meal with Jesus, and it talks about lots of stories about how grace is enacted through sitting down with strangers as well as people that you know in meals, with an intentionality about it, you know. I don't know the answer, really, but I know the best models of church I've experienced are communities who actually live life together,
exactly.
Who actually go into each other's homes, have meals together. But I've seen other models of church where people don't even want you to go into their homes
You've landed on something very important, which we don't have time to go into, but our podcast addresses this. Part of it is the effects of this era of individualism and managerialism on the church. So the church over the recent period has adopted lots of managerial practices. It's become very programmatic. And we've lost this original model that you're talking about. They're actually quite, you know, there are some really thoughtful people writing about this. So it's a thing. And so if your instinct is driving you in that direction, that's something you should really follow.
Yeah, I've always been in that direction, really.
Yeah.
One of the worst things that's happening in society today is this idea that you can work from home.
Mm.
And I'm totally against it personally. Mm-hmm. I think people, if they work in an office, they should turn up at that office and work there. Mm. But so many of them want to work at home now. Mm. You don't get the personal relationship.
The trouble is that a lot of business people like the idea of people working from home because it saves them rent on the offices.
Oh, but a lot of them are making people go back in when it saves them 2 hours of travelling and a lot of cost.
Yeah.
It's not simple, it's not black and white.
Yeah.
No, I think it is black and white. If you will not form relationships if you don't see people.
The thing that's been coming to me while we've been talking just is about churches being in relation with the communities or working together. Do churches need to rethink how much, what they're doing about charging other people to use their premises? Because, I mean, I know of at least one community group that was meeting in a church, and part of the reason why it no longer meets at all is the fact that the charges for being able to meet there went up and they couldn't afford it anymore.
Look, most churches are strapped for cash, aren't they? Mm-hmm. So they need to charge. So to thinking creatively, you know, you're on an island with some quite wealthy people.
Yeah.
So you should maybe have conversations with some of those wealthy people to say, we want to encourage a more relational culture on this island. Mm-hmm. We can't afford to give away our premises for free. Would you sponsor?
It's actually a little bit more difficult than you might expect.
Mm.
Can I just tell you, I just summed up in hours, I'm involved with something called Heart Edge. And a real simple checklist for me is, are we doing this with or for?
Yeah.
Those are the real key
words,
aren't they?
Yeah. Well, this is the last point, and then we're going to round up.
Some brilliant stuff come out on here, because we sat around collectively and been triggered to think about this.
Yeah.
But we need to be critical about the messaging that we're getting in the world that tells us that this is not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the stuff that comes from government and from big corporates.
Mm-hmm.
You must have all seen a Lloyd's banking advert with black horses running around saying, with you for the journey. A corporate company, entity like that, cannot be with you.
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, one of my daughters works at the Department of Work and Pension in the UK. And they have people whose role is to dangle the carrot and thrash with the stick. They call them job coaches, and all these things are uses of language that says this isn't a problem, somebody else is going to do it, somebody will deal with it, and these corporate entities and governments cannot do it. It really has to be another grassroots level.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I just didn't want today to be bogged down in a sort of moaning session. I'm with you, and that's why I started half the session was telling you how terrible things are, because that's true. You know, I think false hope is a terrible disservice. You know, we have to be honest. But we also have to have this narrative that's positive, because people are looking for something. But we don't give false hope. You know, we tell people how it is, and then we say, this is what we do, and this is why we do it. So I'm completely with you. Listen, it's 1:05, so I'm sorry I've made us late. One of the things I really wanted to do at the beginning, which was a slide, is I've got a prayer that I'd love everyone to share together, and Phil has texted it to a few people in the room. Glory be to the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Come, Holy Spirit, we welcome you here in our midst. Govern our hearts and minds. Govern every aspect of our time together. Be in every thought and word, in every intention and motive. Lord, we thank you for those who have been an inspiration to us. Thank you for calling us through the gospel to work together and for each other.
We pray for others working for the common good and for those who resist it. Bind us together across our traditions and move our heart's desire closer to the heart of your desire for us. Lord, give us the grace to do your will and make our mission a joy. In the love of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you. I really enjoyed the morning, so thank you very much. Thank you.